This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. The fastest growing big city in the country isn't Los Angeles or San Diego, Phoenix or Orlando. It's Las Vegas, a junior LA sprouting in the middle of the desert. The city is coming through a period of intense rebuilding. Massive hotel casinos, barely old enough to get worn out, have been bulldozed and replaced with enormous new complexes, incorporating the newest technology and gee-whiz visual effects, and the latest theories on how to most effectively separate a visitor from his or her money. This place, with no clocks, and cowboys who are not cowboys, and ancient Romans who are not ancient Romans, a place of huge, cheap steaks and lion tamers and dancing girls paying mortgages in North Las Vegas, has led more writers to write more drivel than just about any other place on Earth, except maybe New York. Yet, there it is. Las Vegas is waiting to be turned into something. And it has been. Part imaginary journey, part game, part art gallery. Motel Real is not a place we can visit right now in Las Vegas, so it's not quite Real. It's what's left after a change in the weather in the western desert. It's what you find after an enormous, long sandstorm starts to bury Vegas. The Motel Real is what you've got to go on to reconstruct this earlier place, and one of the only artifacts you've got to work with is the scrapbook of a motel janitor. Not just any scrapbook, but a scrapbook meets a one-armed bandit. Photos, newspaper clippings, ads. Motel Real marries something old, a gallery, a book, with the possibilities offered by a CD-ROM, and changes something like a museum visit into much, much more. Jose Marquez joins us from New York. He wrote and co-directed the Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. He's an artist and founding member of South of the Future, an artist and writers collaborative. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Ray. It's South to the Future.
South to the Future. Okay.
Yeah, verb.
I got lost on, you know, the wrong exit ramp here.
You got it.
Mark Taylor is a professor of humanities and religion at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and director of the Center for Technology in the Arts and Humanities at Williams College. He's most recently the author of Hiding, and he co-directed The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to the program.
Delighted to be with you, Ray.
Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And I've spent, a couple of hours on this thing. It's never been the same thing twice, which I guess is built into the experience. But when you first sign on to the disc, there's a memo dated June 21st, 2033, that tells the viewer, there's nothing to this game. It's just an old slot machine. Pick up the token below and deal it or tip it and pass the time away. If you get tired, give it up. And unlike an author who wants to lead his reader or a painter who wants to lead his viewer to a very specific conclusion, you're telling people that this is a journey that, who knows, may not end. Not a very promising beginning. Tell us why, Jose.
Sure. Well, actually, I think you've read it pretty well. The idea is that there really will never be a conclusion to the experience. And that give it up is actually stolen from one of Kafka's shorter stories, where he has this guy walking down the street who interviews a cop, and the cop finally says, you know, stop asking me all these questions, just give it up, right? And that's sort of this foundational moment of stop looking for the meaning in all things in our contemporary culture, which is very superficial and probably something that Mark can tell you more about.
Well, Mark, why Vegas?
Well, Vegas, it seems to me, is interesting in a variety of ways and for a variety of reasons, some of which you've already mentioned. It is a post-war phenomenon in many ways. In the mid-1940s, Vegas was a small town of about 4,500. It's grown to this extraordinary metropolis at this point. Its history is completely tied up not only with gambling, with which people usually associate it, but also, of course, with the military complex there, the test site and the like. So Vegas is interesting, it seems to me, not simply in terms of a metropolitan phenomenon at the end of this millennium, but also as a way of showing us, putting on display, as it were, broader cultural tendencies that are characteristic of the late 20th and early, and I think will be of the early 21st century. So Vegas allows us an angle of vision from which we can see things, it seems to me, going on in our society today that are of crucial importance.
And why, given the many media an artist can work in, work with CD-ROM? What possibilities does it offer in the kind of experience you wanted to offer people who were going to look at your work?
Well, what? I think...
Let me take this one.
Sure.
I think the biggest problem was getting this to places where it wouldn't ordinarily go. And I think you did a really good job of describing it at the beginning, where you said, usually certain people go to museums and they expect certain experiences. We wanted the experience of this particular work of art to be uncertain and unexpected and sort of novel. And we thought the most novel experience would be to have it play out on a computer, as opposed to, you know, video or some sort of theatrical performance. And that's why we chose the CD-ROM. Is more about sort of a smuggling into a location where it would ordinarily not show up than any kind of technological power that it gave us, other than it being sort of a random experience. Every time you play, you get a different set of cards, so to speak.
There's a tremendous amount of restraint involved in the way this is done. And here's what I mean. Often when artists introduce a conceit, and especially when people working with computers introduce a conceit, they're constantly winking at you and reminding you of what the conceit is. Remember, it's the future. Nudge, 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 nudge. Remember, you don't, you know, you weren't in the other Vegas, so you're not a person in 2033 who's carrying all the mental attic around of somebody who's alive in the late part of this century. So remember, it's the future. Again, a hard shove to the ribs. So you give the viewer all this stuff, this visual stuff, this collection of images and ideas, without constantly reminding them that they're supposed to be looking at the fragments of a lost world. Why didn't you play harder on that? Because part of what makes it so incongruous is that it is, by 2033, dated and odd, and will strike the reader in the mid-21st century as odd.
Well, I think that part of what we were trying to do with this medium, as distinct from the medium of a book, this was also a complement to a book that I was writing at the same time, in which many of these issues are probed in book format. The book called Hiding that tries to push the book in the direction of a multimedia hypertext. Whereas in this, what we're trying to do is to take advantage of the multimedia capabilities of CD-ROMs to present a different kind of text, a text that, as you suggest, involves visual images, that involves words, and also that involves sound. Because once you're in a digital environment and bits are your ink, you begin to have to think about how you write with words, sounds, and images. And part of what it seems to me are the cultural condition that Vegas signifies is sort of a breakdown in sort of foundational narrative structures that allow us to have any kind of clear sense of beginning, middle, and end, and pose the challenge for us to create and fabricate various kinds of narratives that serve different purposes. So each of the rooms of the motel has a story, has a narrative, has a character about whom we construct a story through which we then try to expose something about our current cultural condition from a sort of post-apocalyptic kind of vision of Vegas, playing
right,
on all the millenarianism.
Yeah, the post-apocalyptic premise of the story is not to be taken literally, as is nothing else in the CD-ROM. It's more of a position, a perspective that we want the viewer to adopt in order to sort of look at the present differently. And I think when you said at the beginning that Vegas is a place without clocks, which I know is one of the aphorisms in the CD-ROM, you really sort of hit the nail on the head, because we're really talking about a place that is sort of timeless, or that is more about the present than anything else, I think.
I'm playing as we speak, and I just was reminded of the fact that at some point you reach for chips and they disappear. a nice moment and certainly a surprise the first time it happens, because you're, you know, just as you do in Vegas, sort of standing there mechanically feeding chips into the slot machine. And then at one point you reach over for them and they go away.
Right. That's actually really good that you like that, because that was a technical solution to a problem. That was not something that was written into the storyline. It was a problem to do with memory and the fact that most computers can't handle all the things that are going on in the game at any one time. So Noah Peters, who did a lot of the programming for the CD-ROM, said, "Well, can I just get rid of the coins?" I said, "Sure, just make them disappear. That'll be a great solution." And that's why that happens. There's really no. I mean, it's great that there's a meaning to it, but. It's also funny, but
it also highlights one of the themes that we work a lot. In your opening summary, Ray, you mentioned from that first note the phrase "there's nothing to it" or "there's nothing there," and the theme of nothingness runs through a lot of the motel, as I'm sure you noted. But Vegas is, I think, from my point of view, it's always seemed that Vegas is about loss. I think people go to Vegas expecting or hoping to win and come away having learned how to lose. And in many ways, I think that part of the culture into which we're moving, this information culture or this virtual culture, however we describe it, entails a certain kind of loss. Something is vanishing. Something is disappearing. You reach for it and it's never quite there. Currency. The whole way in which, I mean, Wall Street and the Strip are two sides of the same gold, gold brick road. And the very processes of the kind of global economy that we see as money becomes electronic, the currency that we exchange keeps vanishing, as it were, or becoming increasingly light or a matter of light. So that as those tokens disappear, it's also, in addition to being the solution to a technical problem, as Jose says, it also is a very, very important theme in the whole story of the motel, because what the Real ask is precisely, what is real? Where is the real? How in this world of images and information, how are we to define what seems real, what is material, what is substantial, when everything seems immaterial and insubstantial?
One of the initial complaints that we got from some artists who looked at the CD-ROM while it was still in production is that they were very annoyed at having to constantly drop in a coin to turn the page. And the only response I could sort of give to them was, well, good, we're glad that you're annoyed, but also you should check out Vegas, because there people will spend hours, if not days, simply sitting in front of a TV, what's now a video monitor instead of the one-armed bandit, and dropping coins in as if this gesture alone is going to keep them alive. And it's a really powerful thing to watch, and we hope that we can recreate it in the CD-ROM.
Well, it sort of does achieve a physical interaction the way the slot machine does. I was playing this morning for about an hour before I realized, my God, I've been doing this for an hour, and I hadn't thought about it.
But that's exactly what happens in Vegas.
In Vegas, yeah. And well, that's exactly what occurred to me immediately when I thought about that, because in Vegas I didn't do it as much as watched other people do it, and I found it fascinating because you get this sort of attachment to the your face is bathed in light and you're just
that's beautiful.
Very, very much involved in this machine, and you've shut out the rest of the world until your dish of coins is empty or you need a refill of your drink, and then you sort of break that one-to-one attachment to the machine only until such time as you can top up your dish or your glass, and then you can get right back into it again.
And there's always someone there who's willing to do that for you. And that's an important thing, too, is just to note the entire service sector industry that's built up around maintaining your addiction to the machine in Vegas. It's mostly bartenders and waitresses and cocktail girls. These are the people who really keep the machine running, but the machine is supposedly just between you and your luck, or you and your luck as sort of expressed by the machine.
If you're just joining us, you may figure, what are they talking about? Well, we're talking about a lot of things. Jose Marquez and Mark Taylor are with me this hour. They're the co-directors of the CD-ROM, The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a work of art. It's sort of an argument. It's an interesting experience that you're meant to have with a personal computer. You might want to talk about Vegas. You might want to talk about designing art for this still pretty new medium of the CD-ROM. You may want to talk about the way art is changing. Well, whatever. You give us a call, 800-989-8255. Vegas is certainly enjoying its artistic moment. It is attracting the attention of artists, filmmakers, writers, visual artists, and Jose Marquez and Mark Taylor are in that tradition. And I guess Vegas is a pretty good place to pick first when you do this kind of thing. But is any iconic city good material for this kind of treatment?
Could you do it with another? I've actually thought about what it would be like to do the same thing with another city and do it maybe with Florida next, but that would be a state. But it's kind of like a city, too. The reason why we chose Vegas, though, in particular is because we wanted to sort of figure out what America would look like if you use Las Vegas as the starting point, or if you said, if you sort of suggested that Vegas was the capital of an America that most of us would like to pretend America isn't, right? And I think that we kind of succeeded in doing that because we really took every single aspect of Vegas at face value and treated it as important. And in doing so, I think we kind of got out some of the threads of contemporary American culture that are really worth talking about in an artistic or in a political format.
Did you go there a couple of times? Did your view of the place change over time, Mark?
Yes, I've been interested in Vegas for quite a few years. My attention was initially drawn to it by the important role that Las Vegas has played in 20th century architecture. There was a book, of course, written in the late 60s, early 70s by Robert Venturi, Denise Scott Brown, and Stephen Eisenor called Learning from Las Vegas. And that is more or less the book that launched the movement of architecture called postmodernism. And ever since that, I've been intrigued by Las Vegas, and part of what had drawn me to this question was to think a little bit about what Vegas would be like 30 years after Venturi. And again, in Hiding, these are some of the themes that I try to develop. And part of when Venturi and Denise Scott Brown went to Vegas in the 60s, they associated Vegas primarily with automobile culture and correlatively the movies, film and automobile, and they went together in a certain way. The Vegas of the 90s seems to me to be much more about electronic culture and virtual culture than about automobile culture. So it's symptomatic of a shift from the industrial automobile culture to the post-industrial media and information culture. And what we tried to do, to come back to your description of playing the game this morning, was not to do something about Vegas, but to recreate the experience of Vegas in which this in which one becomes immersed in this kind of play of images and virtuality that is so much a part of it. 2 years, at Williams, we have a January term, and 2 years ago I taught a course on Las Vegas and went to Vegas with 30 students. Jose joined us there at that time, and 30 students and myself spent about a little over a week in Las Vegas. It was a trip in more than one sense of the word.
Well, Vegas is a circuit city. My tip is scrolling out here. Vegas is a circuit city where nothing is not.
But the suspense is killing us, right?
Well, my computer must be very slow. Is right. Not for sale. Vegas right, is right. A circuit city where nothing is not for sale. Yeah, I like right. that.
Right. But also read nothing two ways there. Remember, I told you that a lot of this is about nothingness and something disappearing. I
mean, we'll all have some private moments to reflect on nothingness after the show. And also, I think what Mark was talking about when he was saying there's a transition from cars and movies to computers and computer culture. It's also a pun in that phrase, where Circuit City plays as both, you know, a circus city, but also Circuit City, the stores where you can buy electronics in California, which right. is where I'm living right now. And electronics is really almost the thing that you're buying into now when you go to Las Vegas. That's the machine that reveals the truth, or that's the machine that reveals the promise of tomorrow in Vegas, where it was once maybe glamour or sex or booze or even prostitution, which has now been removed from the scene.
But I mean, when you walk down the strip now, it's more like being inside a video terminal or a VR chamber. And indeed, in the Fremont Street experience, they have literalized that in a certain way. Fremont Street is the old downtown section, the old Vegas, which was always sort of the more
right, the glitter
what
gulch.
They call the city. Yeah, Glitter Gulch, not only. What they have done down there now has been to create a 1,500-foot canopy, like this huge arcade that is covered with lights that that are run by computers. So it's and every 20 minutes or so, there's this incredible computer light show. So it's, I mean, you're literally kind of inside this video
and
terminal.
And that's the sky. This is the artificial sky that they created. So instead of looking to the stars, you now look at these LED lights. And that's the experience
You're inside electronic. That's what it is to be in cyberspace.
See, but the reason why I asked if you thought about doing this anywhere else is because it seems that Vegas is the only clear slam dunk among American cities is so ephemeral. And the ephemeral nature of Vegas works beautifully with a CD-ROM where everything can change on the screen after 10 seconds.
Right. So, the same thing. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was going to say, the word ephemeral rate is exactly right, because I think that part of what is happening as we mark this transition from a manufacturing to an information economy is that the so-called realities with which we deal are increasingly ephemeral. Yes, Vegas is the slam dunk, but the slam dunk enables you to see what's going on not so obviously in similar ways elsewhere. I mean, if you want ephemerality, look at Wall Street. I mean, when sometimes people ask me what I mean by virtual reality, I say derivatives. Very, very.
Well, people liken that whole world to casinos. So
exactly, it's a casino economy, sure, right? But that virtual economy, in other words, what people trade now, they don't. We used to trade things, then we traded precious metals. Right now, we trade light. We trade blips on a computer screen, and that's what's running the show. Right? I mean, money has become image. Money has become a matter of light, so that when we talk about the capital of it, we're also talking about capital as, I mean, it's a capital of neon lights, but it's a capital in which the capital, that is the money that is exchanged, is light in every sense of the word.
Mark Taylor is in Williams College, where he teaches, and Jose Marquez joins us from the New York Bureau. They're the co-creators of The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. David joins us from Portland, Oregon. David, welcome.
Hello there.
Hi.
I was just listening to you, and it reminded me of my first experience in Las Vegas, where I walked in, and the first thing I did after looking around was dropping a quarter in a slot machine, and I hit the jackpot. And having been anonymous to all these other people around me and being completely ignored, all of a sudden everyone turned around, realized I hit the jackpot, and that I didn't put four quarters on, and everyone was furious at me, and the anger that came at me was completely unexpected, and I just never have forgotten the experience.
Well, I hope you felt obliged then to take all the money you won and lose it.
I did lose all that money.
Okay, fine. Then you held up your end of the deal then.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, David.
Bye.
Well, there's a good idea about learning how to lose.
Yeah, exactly.
He, I think, might have slept with Fortuna and gotten away with a little bit more than he thought he should. That was the wrath of the other client.
Is there a tendency that an artist might have, and especially an artist from a smart people's college, that you have to squelch in yourself to be arch, to be condescending, to be sort of offhand about Vegas, that ends up being sort of everything that's distasteful about elite art, without necessarily meaning to be.
Right. Well, the whole relationship of Vegas to artistic and even religious traditions in a complicated sort of way, I think, is really quite interesting. I mean, certainly one of the most important developments in art during the same period that Vegas is emerging as this kind of capital, as it were, is a collapsing of the kind of traditional distinction between high art and low art, or high culture and popular culture. And there's one way of understanding that might see that as consistent with the very tradition of high art in some ways. Because if one looks back over the tradition of the avant-garde or leading artists in this century, many of them had as their goal the transformation of the world into a work of art in a certain way. And in a strange sense, the kind of intermixing between image and reality that goes on in Las Vegas realizes that dream. That dream itself is a displacement of a more ancient religious dream. So that in some ways, I think that one could say that that in Vegas, art becomes reality as reality becomes art.
But for us to do the reality, there was a certain amount of translation that took place. I think that may have been what Ray was after, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure. And that's just how to take all these sort of very important lessons from the world of history and philosophy and make them accessible to lots of people who have the same insights and have the same questions, but may not have the vocabulary or be steeped into the literature in quite the same way that maybe Mark is.
Well, you have to resist the temptation to be snotty about Vegas, is what it comes down to.
There's no reason to be snotty about something that's tacky. I think tacky is perhaps the best thing that you can hope for right now, because it certainly kind of guarantees your authenticity, which is obviously a kind of a fake category to begin with.
My guests are Jose Marquez and Mark Taylor. We're going to take a short break right now. When we return, we'll take your calls at 800-989-8255. To contact us here at Talk of the Nation, you can send us email at totn@npr.org or regular mail. Our address here, Talk of the Nation Letters, NPR News, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. You can visit the NPR webpage at www.npr.org and post to the Your Turn section, where you can comment on any and all NPR programs, and there's a special Talk of the Nation section there. Give us a visit. Welcome back to the program. I'm Ray Suarez. Today we're talking about popular culture and the legacy of Las Vegas, Nevada. And you're saying, how could it leave a legacy when it's still there? Well, we're taking a look at a project called The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. It's set in the year 2033 and looks back on the Las Vegas of today, in part. My guests are the artists, Jose Marquez, writer and co-director of the CD-ROM The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. He's an artist and founding member of South to the Future, a collaboration of artists and writers who work with culture, politics, and technology. And Mark Taylor, co-director of The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada, and author of Hiding. He's a professor of humanities and religion at Williams College. If you want to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go next to St. Louis. Charles is with us. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Good. I've been listening to your program, and I work in advertising, which in many ways is kind of like Las Vegas writ large across American popular culture. And I just wanted to hear your guests' comments on how they think Las Vegas and the way it's been portrayed both in the media and the way it exists in reality has affected advertising and perhaps vice versa. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Charles.
Wow, affected advertising in particular, that's going to be kind of tough. I don't think Vegas is really selling anything more than an experience. And maybe in that way it does match up with some of the advertising that's popular today, which is not selling a product so much as a lifestyle or a state of existential clarity with yourself and with your loved ones. So maybe that's kind of your question, is that, or not at all?
Well, where the two worlds intersect.
I think it's certainly the case that advertising has had an enormous influence on Las Vegas in many ways. Indeed, when we try to look at some of the broader cultural processes that we think Las Vegas helps us to understand, advertising is certainly one of them. We mentioned a few minutes ago the whole notion of this casino economy that we have with currencies having become electronic or having become literally current in a certain way. But it's also the case that increasingly what we buy and sell, what we traffic in, are not the things themselves so much as their images. We trade images as much as things. And that kind of trafficking, as it were, in images certainly is not possible without and is inseparable from advertising. So understanding the kinds of processes going on in Vegas help us to understand the stakes of advertising in a post-industrial media economy, and vice versa, it seems to me. That strip is a two-way street, to be
and
sure.
And I would want to emphasize the notion of stakes there, because that is something that runs throughout this particular project, and that's that real people and real pain or real suffering or real loss is basically what's fueling this economy, Las Vegas, and I think ours as well. I mean, just the national economy. What we've tried to concentrate on are some personal stories and some really how do you say, charismatic figures that we can get to talking about.
800-989-8255. North Hollywood, California is next. Jill, welcome.
Hello, hi. I just wanted to know, I worked in Vegas as a young person, as a dancer at the Sands Hotel. And what you're saying is right on. I mean, it's incredible. I'm 50 years old now, so I was back in 1966 there. The town has changed a lot, but it was interesting. I would never go back, though.
You've actually gone in the other direction. I think most people from the Hollywood, Los Angeles area are leaving L.A. and going to Las Vegas to relocate.
No, I had to go there last year for a wedding, and it brought back such terrible memories.
But I would have thought that it would have changed so much, Jill, that it was hardly the same place that you had been.
No, but the same thing drives it. And, well, not exactly. I mean, in the time I was there, was a lot more into sex and alcohol and drugs and things like that, and money, and glamour and glitz, than it is now. It's the same thing now, but it's more family-oriented, but it's so much louder. I couldn't believe how much louder it was. You used to walk into a casino, and it was dead silent. And now you walk in, and you're bombarded by music and noise and bells and whistles.
No, the auditory dimension of Vegas is really quite extraordinary. I think you're quite right that it's not only a visual experience, but it's the sound and everything that goes with it. I think that's quite right. The other big change, of course, in the years since you were there has been the movement into Vegas of large corporations and these huge hotel entertainment destination entertainment centers.
Exactly.
There are now, I think this is correct, something like 11 out of the 12 largest hotels in the world are in Vegas, and that's really quite remarkable.
It's amazing. I was there also in 1954 when my parents got divorced, and I spent 8 weeks on a dude ranch there.
Right.
At the year I was 8 years old. And that was a completely different experience, too.
But again, I think it's also important to come back, and this is one of the themes that we try to touch in the CD, to the importance not only of the gambling interests and the entertainment interests, but also of the interesting and important relationship between Vegas and the military and the development of the test site, the nuclear test site, and the like. Mm-hmm. In the early 60s and the like, Vegas used to the hotels and casinos in Vegas used to advertise to people to come, have an enjoyable weekend, gamble, and watch the detonation of nuclear bombs. And they would actually have pictures to this effect. There's a very intricate and kind of complicated relationship. The federal government owns some huge portion, something like 80 or 85% of the land in the state of Nevada. I mean, it's a very complicated kind of economy in very, very many ways. When Ray was asking a few minutes ago about other examples of cities or the like that might exemplify what we're talking about, one place where some cultural critics have gone is to Disney World and the like. And it's always seemed to me that Vegas is much, much more interesting than Disney World, though symptomatic of some of the same tendencies. It's precisely the complexity of the various kinds of economies at work in Las Vegas that make it much more interesting than some of these others.
Jill, you mentioned
Disney doesn't want to be known as a Las Vegas of, a Florida or California. But they are. But they're for children.
Well, Jill, you alluded to that when you mentioned that right now people are trying to repackage Las Vegas away from booze and sex and gambling toward being a family destination.
Oh, definitely.
And I'm wondering how that changes the place. I mean, looking, Jose and Mark, at your work, I don't get the sense that there are a lot of kids in this picture. It was much more the sort of scrubby desert subdivision feeling and a frontier newspaper.
It was, although there were families. I lived for a while with a family that had their kids had grown up in Las Vegas. They were born in Las Vegas. They were really country people. They were from Oklahoma. There were a lot of country people there. And they made it like a small town.
It's more
so there
of the
was
wild.
The Baptist side of the small town, and then there was the gambling side of the small town.
Although it was funded by Mormons, which is even more interesting, considering their prohibitions.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that the effort to make it more of a family destination took place during the 80s, and I think that there are a lot of...
It's not
been
very successful.
Yeah, and that's why they're building places like New York, New York, or maybe the other one that's sort of European, what's it called? What's it called?
Monte Carlo.
Exactly. I mean, I think they're trying to create, they're trying to recreate the sense of glamour and of glitz, but they're doing it by building these kind of artificial worlds, and that's their new approach.
Yeah, but the motivation for that is purely economic in this sense. First of all, it's not been very successful. This effort to make it a family destination has not been very successful. The kind of theme park at MGM that they developed, which is sort of a knockoff of Disney World in a certain way, has been more or less a flop. But the reason that they moved in that direction was that in once these large corporations began building casino resorts, in order to be successful financially, they had to expand their customer base beyond those who ordinarily gambled. And in order to do that, they tried to make the city more user friendly for families, just to spread gambling. Now, in the years since that all started, gambling in a variety of forms has become much more culturally accepted throughout the country. But that was one of the primary motivations for the family resort kind of move. It's not been terribly successful, I think.
And why don't I get the feeling when I comb through the hallways of the Motel Real that very many kids have come with these families?
You know, you really don't see that many kids when you go through the casinos. I mean, maybe I didn't because I was going there at the wrong times, but they're usually shuttled off to the recreation center, which is not very different from the play, the jungle gyms at McDonald's or something. They're put into a separate space, and they're not really brought into the main experience of Vegas, which is still the betting floor. That's the main draw. That's what families are really going there for. It's for the father and the mother, I think, or the grandparents as well, to spend 2 or 3 days either playing blackjack with strangers from another part of the city or another part of the country rather, or to spend that time in front of a video screen dropping quarters in. That's still the main draw.
One of the other things that really strikes me about Las Vegas in comparison to some of the other more kid-friendly resorts is that if you look at a place like Disney World or Disneyland, it's preoccupied with the whole issue of nostalgia, of trying to recreate an earlier time and nostalgia is not, there is no nostalgia in Vegas. I mean, it's as if Vegas forgets that it's forgotten in certain ways. I mean, the past, the relationship to the past is very, very different. It is a concentration in the present in a certain way. And it seems to me to be a place as free of nostalgia as any I've known for a long time.
Jill, somewhat free of optimism as well, I think. No, I mean, it's a very dark place.
Right. Yeah.
Jill in North Hollywood, California, thanks for your call. Lincoln, Nebraska's next. Becky, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Listen, I've been listening to cultural criticism, and I've been listening to you all talk about nothing. And what I'm wondering, as an American and as a potential buyer of this product, is why I do this for nothing? And what I really want to know is there a politics to the Real?
Jose, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure, yeah. There is, and I think that I tried to get at it a little bit of that earlier when I was talking about the people who keep Vegas running. And it is mostly people in the service sector. It is mostly waiters and maids and porters. And it's their reality that I think needs to be examined a little bit more closely when you look at a city like Vegas, especially if you look at Vegas to be symptomatic of America in general. One of the people who I talked to when I visited Vegas was this guy named Glenn Arnotto. And Glenn is the media person for the local union. And he was really articulate in talking about how if you look at the kinds of jobs and the kind of labor issues that are going on in Vegas right now, you're really getting a good sense of what's happening with labor throughout the country. And in writing stories about people, which is what the Motel Real is really about, 52 different people, you really are telling the story of America. You're telling the story of, you know, of these kinds of struggles and dreams and of very harsh realities that people confront when they try to realize their dreams and run up against a certain amount of walls.
Well, let's meet the security guard at the Real, who I just happened to stumble upon as I was walking through the hallways here. Becky, stand by.
Okay.
His pride and joy is an 84 white Ford F-150 truck. He bought it in Bakersfield, California, from Haslam Brothers Motors. He likes to watch boxing and kickboxing on ESPN 2. The security guard is an attractive man. He has a tattoo on his
Isn't that like the ATM machine?
We meet this security guard. We find out that he's a Vietnam veteran, that he's got a tattoo, that he drives an F-150 Ford pickup, and it's all delivered in this sort of, it's a machine voice. And he moves like a machine. His arms jerk, his legs jerk, and I guess there's a politics to the depiction of this man in this way.
The police can't be everywhere in Las Vegas, and yet they're required to be everywhere. So what the individual casinos do is they hire a really extensive security force to actually beat people up when they get out of line. And these people are kept in these sort of holding pens until the police arrives. And I'm sorry, go ahead, Mark.
No, I was just going to say, in addition to that, I mean, the whole security phenomenon in Las Vegas and how, I mean, it's not just that men are people acting as machines like this, but the way in which security and surveillance pervades Las Vegas and the whole problem of, you know, security and securities in this kind of economy is very, very complicated. So that the human extension that they embody in there has as its complement this extraordinarily complicated kind of electronic surveillance system that is everywhere in Las Vegas, as it is everywhere in contemporary culture.
Yeah, there's another room that's dedicated to the idea of surveillance or the eye in the sky, which is what dealers refer to. If there's a dispute between a dealer and a patron, what happens then is that the person on the floor sort of defers to the eye in the sky, which is the security camera, which is pointed at every single table in every single casino in Las Vegas. And then that camera is being monitored by a bunch of people in a room, and they'll go back and play the videotape over again to make sure that the cards were dealt correctly or that the right card was dealt to the right person, etc. And this is a constant sort of presence, this invisible security system. And it's one of the rooms that we have sort of plays with that by having this camera determine the guilt or the not guilt of someone who is who has a lot of personal effects in Vegas.
On the issue of the politics of this that Becky raises also, I think it's important to underscore, again, the way in which the kinds of processes that we explore going on in Las Vegas reflect or shed a certain kind of light on what we understand to be some of the implications of the contemporary forms of capitalism that are fueling the global economy. Again, the kinds of processes at Vegas give you a perspective on these broader issues of post-industrial capitalism.
Becky, did Mark and Jose answer your question?
They did. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Becky joining us from Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joe is with us now from Chicago. Hiya, Joe.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. Your guests mentioned something, and maybe I misunderstood them, about the religious connotation of the Las Vegas experience. And I'm wondering if, it seems to be the complete antithesis of any religions that I'm familiar with. You know, it's founded by killers, gangsters, hoodlums, what have you.
And Mormons. But maybe you mean the same.
Well, I'm talking about what makes Vegas run now. You know, the Bugsy, what's his name?
Siegel.
Yeah, when he brought the institution there, what was it, the Sands? I'm not sure which hotel it was. But then prostitution is legalized, gambling is legalized, consumption of alcohol is one of the prime things that go on when you're visiting there. I don't think there's any too many religions that preach the practice of this stuff. And I was just wondering what that's, as it grows larger and larger, more and more people are partaking that. Is that saying something about the American culture and what it's, what it's focused on?
Well, Joe, that means that's an excellent question. It's a complicated, you raise a complicated set of issues, and I'll try to address some of them because it's something that I've thought about in many ways. There is a certain kind of sense in Las Vegas, it seems to me, in which the kind of city in the desert, this kind of city in the wilderness, that has been so much a part of the Western religious tradition is very, very important. Vegas would not be the same kind of phenomenon that it is were it not in the desert. I remember when they opened Atlantic City, there was a concern that it would drain away from Vegas, but it didn't. And I think part of the reason for that is that the location of the city in the desert is very, very important. The broader issue that you raise, yes, many of the things that we associate with Las Vegas seem, as you correctly say, to be the antithesis of religion. But opposites have a curious way of collapsing into each other in many ways. And certainly within the Western religious tradition, for example, within the Christian religious tradition, there's a strong sense, at least in some of it, that part of what the gospel message entails is a sense of what they call the realization of the notion of the kingdom of God on earth, that what is what ought to be, that there is nothing beyond this, that reality is, as it were, fully manifest here and now. It's not delayed, it's not deferred, it's not put off into the future, but it is here and now. And there is a certain kind of strange sense in which this kind of preoccupation with the present that Jose and I have been talking about, a loss of nostalgia, and in a certain sense, a loss of expectation, represents some kind of image of that kind of sense. It, on the face of it, it looks like the opposite of religion, but it's not, it seems to me. I always find religion most interesting where it's least obvious. It's least obvious in Vegas, and there is, it seems to me, a very, very important religious dimension to all of culture, but certainly to Vegas as well. Jose, you might be able to clarify some of that.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I just want to sort of stress what the main points of the experience of playing the CD-ROM might be for the average user or viewer, and that's to really confront what loss can be about, and it's to confront what our expectations are, and also what our expectations are of Vegas. I think Vegas is a really powerful cultural term. It means as much to people as maybe Nike or I don't know, Quentin Tarantino. These are buzzwords that people associate with all sorts of meanings. And I think Vegas is certainly a powerful word. And we wanted to sort of take apart what those meanings are. And that's what we tried to do with this particular CD-ROM, which I guess Ray is playing as we speak.
Well, I was trying to get us to some more promising audio moments, but you're just going to have to take my word for it.
It has a mind of its own,
that,
right?
That this is a visual feast. The sounds are interesting, but don't really tell you exactly what they're all about. I'm interested in the choice, the obviously purposeful choice, of the cheesy, glowing cover.
Right.
Sure, the holographic foil. No, right. Ralph Keller, who did the illustrations for the cover and for a large part of the CD-ROM, had to pay a lot of, I guess he got browbeaten a lot by the printers who were doing this foil, because it's a prismatic holographic foil. No one wanted to touch it, but there was really nothing else that would work as well to suggest that this is a prism. This is something that you look at, and it produces all sorts of different visions, hopefully of Vegas. And in
different
using
lights.
That cheap... Yeah, different. It's also what maybe sand would look like if it was broken down into silicon, which is kind of what the original opening sequence is about, the sand swallowing Vegas. The sand is both sand in terms of biblical sand, but it's also sand in terms of silicon. And now that Vegas has become an electronic city, what kind of a city is that, and what does it make us see, and what kind of lights does it bring to our attention?
What different lights does it shed on our society?
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us this hour. Mark Taylor, a pleasure to have you by.
My pleasure, Ray.
And Jose Marquez, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Jose Marquez is a writer and co-director of the CD-ROM The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada. He's an artist and founding member of South to the Future. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. And Mark Taylor is co-director of The Real, Las Vegas, Nevada, and author of Hiding. He's a professor of humanities and religion at Williams College and joined us from the studios at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Join Talk of the Nation this time tomorrow for a look at the 20th century arts and crafts movement. In Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, NPR News.